I've been sitting here observing and so thankful for you and for your interest. Arlene and I are delighted to be with you. I was thinking about the lesson when Brother Rouse called me a couple of nights ago and asked if I'd sort of lead this period. And I came up with this outline that I hope will be of help. I'm not going to just read it to you. We'll do some discussion, of course, along the way about it. But basically, I call it, at the time of it, Requirements of a Godly Life. But I would have to tell you, it's really a lesson about influence. You remember Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, said, "You're the salt of the earth." But if salt has lost its flavor, what's it good for? But to be cast out and trodden under the foot of man. You're the light of the world. A city is not set on a hill, cannot be hidden. And a light is not put under a bushel, but is set on a candlestick that it might give light to all around. So let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. What do you think Jesus is really saying in that little part about the Sermon on the Mount? You're the salt of the earth, you're the light of the world. Do you feel any application for your own life? What's that talking about? About influence. And I don't mind you speaking up. In fact, I kind of want you to kind of share with me some thoughts tonight. The fact is that we all have influence. I mean, you may say, "Oh, I can't influence it," but sometimes it's negative influence. Sometimes, and I hope it is always, a positive influence for those who are Christians. Share a little personal story with you. We moved to Orlando some 23 years ago. And one of our daughters, we have three daughters and one son. In fact, our oldest daughter, our first child, is the mother of Nicole. And Nicole is our first granddaughter, and Brooks is our first great-grandchild. So we're delighted to be here just to be with them. But when we moved to Orlando, we had a daughter. One of our children was a student at Auburn. Well, it just turned out that first year we were here, both the University of Alabama and University of Auburn football teams came to Gainesville to play the Gators. And I've lived in Alabama quite a lot. Back in earlier days, we lived in the Birmingham area, then in the Florence area. And actually, I was in this area back in the days when the Bear Bryant was winning national championships at Alabama. And so, of course, at that time, I'm just new in Florida, and I'm pulling for both Alabama and Auburn. Got a daughter in school at Auburn. Well, one of our elders happened to have seats, and it had these seats for years, right about on the 50-yard line. And so he said, "You know, I'll let you and Arlene have those seats for the Alabama and Auburn game." Well, we go up, the first game is against Alabama. And I'm in a van with real Florida fans, and you know, I'm giving them a hard time all the way up there, and we stop for lunch right before the afternoon game, and one of the men buy me a gator cap. "You have to wear it." Okay, well, I didn't have a cap. We sit down, and the sun is shining. But just before we get out and go our separate places, they tell me, said, "Now look," they said, "it's all right for you to kid us, but," said, "there's a fellow just sitting right down close to you called the coach. And said, it's best you not say much during the game." Well, sure enough, the coach, you know what that means? Every time that Florida didn't score a touchdown, just about, if they went right, they should have gone left. If they ran, they should have passed. You know, he was always griping about what Florida was not doing right. He was the coach. I stepped up pretty quietly. I tell you, Alabama won. And I didn't even yell one time because of the coach. I knew not to do that. Well, it was a hot afternoon. The sun was beaming down on us, and I had a cap. So Arlene goes up and buys a little sun visor cap. And all they sell is a gator cap. So 2 weeks later, we come to watch Auburn play. And we get there early. Same group in the van, you know. We've become friends. So we go in, and as we're going down to our seats, and I've got this gator cap on. She has this gator sun visor, and there's a young woman going to sit right next to me, and the coach is going to be under the side. As we start into our seats, she says, "Oh, goody, I was so afraid I was going to have to sit by some Auburn fans, and you've got those gator caps on." And I said, "Well, I'll tell you the truth, we got a daughter in school at Auburn right now, and we really are pulling for Auburn." She said, "Oh, Auburn." I said, do you know the coach? She said, who? I said, the fellow sitting on the other side of you. She said, oh. No, she said, somebody gave me this ticket and said, I've never sat here before. And I said, well, I kind of told her about it. Kick off to Auburn. Auburn drives right down to the, like, the one-yard line, and then, you know, the ball is snapped, and you know how everybody piles up right there trying to drive in for the goal. And this girl thinks they've stopped it. She jumps up and yells. I see the referee's hand go up, touchdown, and I just sit there quiet. Coach doesn't say anything at that point until they kick off to the Gators, and somehow about the second down or so, they complete about a 20-yard pass, and she jumps up and yells again. And the coach says, young lady, I wish you'd make up your mind who you're pulling for. By the fourth quarter, the coach is really frustrated. He leans over and says, I never thought I'd rather sit by an Auburn fan than a Gator fan, but this coach is running me nuts. He had given her a hard time that whole game. Was he an influence? You know, he had a reputation before I ever met him. This guy thinks he knows ball better than anybody else. He's a coach. I can't even tell you his name. I just remember him as the coach. And always griping or yelling only for Florida. Payne sitting next to him. You have an influence. It's either for good or it's for bad. What kind of influence are you? What kind of light is shining from you? Salt that has lost its flavor is good for nothing but to be what? Cast down, trodden underfoot. Salt needs to permeate. Salt needs to preserve. Light needs to shine so others can see the way to go. And actually, you know, you may think you're not really an influence, but you are, one way or the other. In fact, you may not know who's watching your life. This outline has 7 points, and you may notice that every one of the points starts with a C. And I want you to stop and think, you know, if I'm an influence for good, if I'm an influence of light or of salt that really still is of value, then, first of all, I need to have conviction. I need to have commitment. I need to have courage. I need to have in my life the fourth point is confidence in God. And as a result of confidence in God, the calmness of spirit, the Christ-like spirit, and ultimately and finally the consistency. To say, first of all, you have to have conviction. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, it says, sanctify the Lord in your hearts and be ready always to give an answer to every man concerning the hope that is within you, every meekness and fear. How do you do that? What does it mean? Be ready to answer to every man concerning the hope that's within you. I have an answer. What does that mean to you? I know some of you talk, so lighten up. Does it mean that it doesn't matter what you believe, that you just accepted what your parents believed? How many of you here because your parents were Christians? How many here because you understood and were converted? Yeah, that's a better hand. How many of you have parents who are Christians? Yeah. Well, I'm glad you reacted that way. Conviction. Because you have to say, I know in whom I believe. I know what I believe. I know why I believe it. You remember the story of Daniel? Probably in this audience you've all studied Daniel. It's a great story. Daniel was taken captive. Anybody know about how old he might have been? We usually give the date somewhere around 606 B.C. It was a time when really the Babylonian Empire was just really becoming the world power. Nebuchadnezzar had been a general that had led the Babylonian army, first of all, in defeating the Assyrians, and then as the Pharaoh of Egypt was testing him, he was really battling and chasing them back down to Egypt when he learned that his father, Nabopolassar, had died. And so Nebuchadnezzar turns to go back to Babylon to assume the throne as king. And on the way, he stops through Judah, you might say, and Jerusalem particularly. He takes the first wave of captives, among whom And the only others that we know are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That is, that's the Babylonian name given it. They're taking captives. Anybody can guess how old Daniel might have been at that point in time? All right. Got one young man that'll answer. Matt, how old was he, Larry?
My notes say 15 years old.
I'm not sure how the note knew it was 15. We usually say a young teenager, somewhere around probably 14.
14 to 17.
Anybody know what he was like? He's a handsome young man. Very smart young man. And he's a teenager. Actually, how many know the story of Daniel in the lion's den? Anybody heard that story yet? That's in chapter 6. How old do you think he was in chapter 6? Guess? Anybody got a guess? Huh?
80.
That's a pretty good guess. Why would you say 80?
Some preacher said that one time.
That's a preacher. Well, actually, I'll tell you how you know. When you finish chapter 1, it said it continued until the time of Cyrus, who was the king of Persia. Jeremiah the prophet had in fact predicted the fact, or prophesied the fact, that these Israelites from Judah would be taken into Babylonian captivity. It even named Nebuchadnezzar as king. And he said they would be in captivity 70 years. One of the reasons we can trust the Bible to be the word of God and not just the word guesswork of men is fulfilled prophecy. No way Jeremiah could have known 70 years. But we have that affirmed, even by secular history, affirms the fact the time they were taken in, say, 606 or 605 B.C. And in fact, it was in 536 B.C., 70 years later, that the first remnant comes back to Judah. And that's under the leadership of approval of Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persians. So if you date 70 years in captivity, he starts at, say, 14. 70 years later, he's 84. So though the story of Daniel is told rather quickly and rather interesting, right? There's quite a history, a lot of years that are not told. But when Daniel goes, he's a young man, maybe 14 years old, probably younger than everybody in this audience, right? How would you like to have been taken away from your family? Taken to a strange place? Taken to a heathen land? You're a faithful Jew. You know the Lord. You know something about the Lord. And yet, you're taken to this strange place of idolatry. In fact, your name is changed. They give you the name Belteshazzar. I mean, you don't want to be named Belteshazzar, but that's the worship of an idol god among the Babylonians. And so, here you are, and you know what they try to do with Daniel and his friends? Anybody know the story? What do they do for him? They're going to give him an opportunity to do what? Anybody know? Nobody knows that story?
We're going to eat with the king.
Right. They're going to serve with the king, aren't they? And they're supposed to be able to eat the king's meat and drink the king's wine. And they're taught the language of the Chaldeans. He's given an opportunity to serve in the king's council. Now, you know, that's quite an honor. That's quite an opportunity. He's a Jew boy and taken many miles away from home, but he's because he's handsome and because he's intelligent, and he's going to be taught the way of the Babylonians. But what's Daniel refused to do right off? Anybody know? Daniel 1 and verse 8. Nobody knows the story. He refuses to eat the king's meat and drink the king's wine. Daniel 1 and verse 8 said he made up his mind. King James Version says he purposed in his heart. He had conviction. Now, we're not really told what it is about the king's meat that he wouldn't eat, but he knew according to the law of Moses, it was not right. It might have been that it was meat that had been sacrificed to idols. That very well could have been, because he's gone to an idolatrous nation. In fact, as a Jew, could a Jew eat just any meat? Did it matter what a Jew ate? The matter meat? What did it matter? Was there some meat he couldn't eat? Anybody know? What kind of meat could he not have eaten? Unclean. Anybody know something that's unclean to the Jew? But today, what would be unclean today that you sometimes eat? Huh?
They could eat like fish
animals?
Yeah, certain animals. But what in our, if you were to go to a restaurant and you order anything, you'd order it at a restaurant.
She said pigs.
Yeah, did you say pigs? Okay, I didn't hear.
Of
ham, catfish, that's all unclean meat to the Jew. Now, it could have been meat like that. It might have been that it wasn't properly blooded. They would have let the blood out. They could not eat blood. Or it might be this, it was sacrificed. I'm not sure why. But it took conviction to say, no, I'll not eat. In fact, what do you think could have happened? He's telling this king of a world empire, at least the servant that's in charge of him, you can report this to the king. I'm not going to eat the king's meat or drink the king's wine. You may think this is a special opportunity for me, but I refuse to defile myself, the language of the Bible. He had conviction. In fact, it could have caused his death. You ever thought about that? He could have been put to death right there. He could have said, look, so what? You know, on the other hand, he could have rationalized and said, well, you know, maybe if I'll eat this, and, you know, I'll get in situation ethics, you know. I'm here as a captive, and I'm away from home, and what an opportunity if I could just serve in the king's council. Should I do that? I sometimes illustrated it. I said, what if the President of the United States were to send out a commission throughout all of the 50 states of our country and say, we want to find the most handsome young man or the most beautiful young woman, the most intelligent, we're going to run a test. And we want them to come up to Washington, D.C. and serve in our special council. And you go through all the land, and you are the one that picked. You are the one, maybe the smartest young woman or the most intelligent young man. Out of all the states, you're the one that's picked. Would you be thrilled? Would you think, no, I can serve in the president's council? But then you learn, might mean that you're going to have to socialize and drink with alcohol with others that, you know, maybe you got to be, you know, group right with the people who come, the other from other nations. In fact, it might even be sometimes you got to tell a few white lies, you know. All politicians, it seems today, sometimes have a way of sort of making a spin that it sort of colors the truth sometimes, and you know, you got to get along. Maybe you're going to be with some ambassadors from other nations that you sort of have to kind of play politics. Would you still go? Or could you say, I will not defile myself? Influence starts with what your convictions are. Would you be a Daniel? Would you be, all right, Brother Larry?
You know, the chief of the eunuchs ended up cooperating with Daniel. You talk about influence. He put his own head at risk. And, you know, it's interesting how conviction sometimes, when you stand, how some people who otherwise might not have courage follows along.
Yes, exactly the point. That even, you know, it didn't just endanger Daniel's head. It endangered the eunuch that was in charge of him. He said, my own head might be involved. But he allowed 10 days of trial. Give them vegetables and water. And if after that 10 days they looked all right, then he would let them go this way for the 3 years of training. And, of course, God permitted it. Conviction has to start. Why do you believe what you believe? Are you willing to stand for it regardless of the cost? Well, the second point, if we're really going to be a good influence, is commitment. Now, obviously, these all tie one with the other. But sometimes we say, I've got conviction, but commitment? Do you have a price that you would maybe yield your conviction? If you got to serve in the President's Council, and what an honor it'd be, and maybe it's only for a temporary period of time, would you sort of say, well, you know, for a few years it'll be all right to go along with the world. Maybe for a little while it'd be, would your commitment be only governed by the situation? Because sometimes we read them, you know, or certain things. There's a story told, and I put it in your outline, about the young woman who was seated at a banquet beside a multimillionaire. And the man offered to her, he said, for $100,000, I give you $100,000 if you'll spend the weekend with me. And she thought, $100,000? she agreed, okay.
He said, well,
he said, that being settled, what would you charge me for just tonight? To which she replied, what do you think, I am a prostitute? And he replied, well, that's already been settled. Now we just need to know, you know, what is your price for tonight? What price would you give your conviction for? If someone says, oh, everybody's got a price. Is there something in your own life that you would maybe not be as committed to your conviction as you say you are? What is your commitment to the Lord? Ever heard somebody say, well, you know, I've been unfaithful to the church. People who have fallen away from the church need to repent and pray to God for forgiveness, right? You think that's the right way to say that? Your conviction is not based upon the church, is it? Your conviction is based upon the Lord. Our commitment is to the Lord. And there are those who are unfaithful to the Lord. It's not just they've fallen away from the church, they fall away from the Lord if, for whatever reason, they've yielded their conviction. And for the moment's pleasure or for the moment's price, they have left their conviction and done that which is evil. What's your influence? I tell you, when you stand up for something, Daniel really stood up for something that, as Brother Rice said, really made an impression even on the eunuch that was in charge of him. And then commitment. No doubt, as Daniel stood, so it affected, no doubt, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But the third point is that if we really have an influence for good, that it needs to have a kind of courage that will stand regardless. Daniel, indeed, had to have courage to do what he did. It's easy to be strong when everybody else around us is strong. You are blessed people. I know you're all students, or most of you, if not all, are students in a large university. A lot of other young people don't care about serving the Lord. They think you're rather foolish even to spend a Sunday evening like this. But you are blessed. Look how many there are even just in this room, and I know there are many others who did come tonight. But you have some fellow companions who stand with you. And that's not, you know, it's easier to stand when you're not standing alone. It's easier to stand when you have someone who is with you. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 13, he said, watch ye, stand fast, quit you like men. In other words, be strong. The admonition that we need to have courage to stand for what we believe in. And that, it does take courage. It says, no matter what, Daniel, no matter what, even if he lost his life, he was going to stand for it. And really that ties in with the next point, and that is that it was the reason because he had confidence in God. In 2 Timothy chapter 1, you probably know the verse, we sing a song even, I know in whom I believe. And I'm persuaded he's able to keep that which I've committed unto him against that day. I know in whom I believe. Daniel believed God could alter his circumstances. And he did. He ate vegetables and water for 3 years. You know, at the end of 3 years, what the scripture said about him and his mates? Hear this with you? As a way of describing, many times worse, is 10 times better than those who had spent that 3 years eating the king's meat and drinking the king's wine. There are the stories in Daniel where there's the confidence that God will see to bless. I mean, you know the story about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being thrown in the fiery furnace. Anybody know that story? Daniel chapter 3, what brought it about? Remember?
He was trying to lie.
Yeah, there was a golden image that was set up. And of course, Idolatrous was king. And so the king went out at a certain time, and there would be certain musical instruments played. And whenever you hear the sound of the harp, and you hear the sound of the musical instruments that are all in unison with each other, everyone is to do what? Bow down and worship. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not. So they got reported to the king, didn't they? In fact, the decree was, if you don't bow down and worship the idol, be thrown into the fiery furnace. And when it was reported to the king, he was angry at them. They brought before the king, and it was just, I can't believe this. Is it really true that you didn't bow down? I tell you what, we'll give you another chance. And when the musical instruments are played, if you'll just bow down to this image, then it'll be all right. Otherwise, you'll be thrown in the fiery furnace. Is it really true? Daniel chapter 3, put it in own words. Those three servants of God said, you can do it again, but what you heard is really true. And in effect, we don't care. We trust in God. And whatever you do, we're not going to bow to that idol if you throw us in the fire furnace. In fact, we believe God will keep us. But even if he doesn't, let it be known, we'll not worship an idol. I tell you, that's quite confidence. God will protect. And in that story, God did protect. They were thrown in the fire furnace. Even those men who took them up to the furnace, the heat of the furnace killed the men who put them into it. But not even a hair on their head was singed, and the smoke of the fire did not even into their garments. Yes.
One of the encouraging passages that I've read over the years is Jesus, when he was on the cross, Psalms 22 gives his mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And Psalms 22:3, it says, but you are holy, enthroned in the praises of Israel. Our fathers trusted in you. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried to you and were delivered. They trusted in you and were not ashamed. And to me, this verse reminds me a lot of your lesson this morning of where God answers prayer. He delivers. You're thankful to him. He's enthroned in the praises of Israel. The development of a confidence in God goes back to seeing what he has done for you in the past.
Right.
And so that's always been a beautiful verse to me, is that if I'm going to stand in adversity, I need to already have known how God has been working and helping and providing and be praising him.
Absolutely.
You want to read that letter?
Why don't we do that? Let's look at in Daniel chapter 6. And this one is really Daniel's life then. Anybody know the story of why Daniel was thrown in the lion's den? Really out of jealousy. Those who were jealous of Daniel's position now, and as we've already said, it's some 70 years later, and now we really have Darius, who is the king of the Medes, and who really likes Daniel, but they have come to the king at a time when he's not thinking just about Daniel. And they said, oh, you know, you're such a great king. Why don't you send out a petition that, you know, that for 30 days, if any man bows and prays to any other being other than you, O king, let him be thrown up into the lion's den. Of course, the king, like so many times rulers, if they're not careful, gets to think pretty highly of himself, and that sounds pretty good. And he sent out the petition. But Daniel, even though the petition, and of course it was intended to capture someone like Daniel, that he would be praying to his God. In fact, what did Daniel do after the decree was made during that 30 days? As he always did, the scripture says, yeah, he went to his room with a window open facing Jerusalem, prayed three times a day. Of course, when the word came to the king, indeed, Daniel has violated your petition. At that time, the king could not change his petition. I mean, it was the decree of the king, and it would stand. And even though it grieved the king, Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. And what kind of night did the king spend? You may remember? It was a pretty sleepless night. In fact, early the next morning, he rushes to the lion's den, only to find that Daniel has been protected by God from the lion. So let's read. What does the king say in Daniel chapter 6? Verses 25 through 27. Someone will read it for us? I don't know all of you by name, so go ahead and read.
Then King Darius wrote, to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions?
All right. What an impression it made even on this king. And basically, you might say a Gentile, an idolatrous king. And he recognized the God of heaven. Daniel's preserved. As I said, Daniel now, if he's taken captive at age 14, and 70 years later, he's in his 80s. You think about your own life. What kind of person will you be 50 years from now? If you allowed to live 60 years from now, or even 70 years. Someone said, if you want to know what you'll be in your old age, take a look at what you are in your youth. Because you plant the seeds for the kind of individual you'll be the rest of your life. That doesn't mean you cannot fall away, and you may fall away. But you started your life in the right way. What Daniel is as an old man is seen in him as a young man. He had conviction. He had commitment to the Lord. Indeed, he had the courage to stand apart regardless of the consequences. He was the kind of man who truly, as an older man, finally was blessed because the Lord indeed provided for him. That confidence in the Lord really then flows into the next one. It's calmness. Calmness in the midst of trials. Let's look at Philippians chapter 4. And this really relates even, of course, to the Apostle Paul as a New Testament example of someone who experienced many trials and persecutions. And yet, Paul could make some statements that really should, we'd all like to say, I wish I could be like this. Philippians 4, verses 11 through 13. What did you say? Might I have that one? Go ahead.
Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me.
All right. Is that the English Standard Translation? Do you remember?
New American Standard.
Okay. He said, I've learned whatever state I am there with to be content. What does contentment mean to you? It doesn't mean laziness, far from that. It's a calmness of spirit. It carries the idea that, you know, you've got deep roots. A storm comes through, and the trees that have good roots stand the test of the storm. And there is really the kind of person who can say, I'm content in whatever state I am. Paul can say, I've learned how to be filled, and I've learned how to be hungry. I've learned how to suffer need. And in 2 Corinthians 11, he spoke about many different trials he had in life. Beat 5 times the Jews, 40 times save one. 3 times with rods. Stoned and left for dead. In shipwreck 3 times. In perils of robbers, and various perils of hunger. And yet he could say, I've learned to be content. In other words, I've learned to stand. How could he have that calmness of his spirit, do you think? Look at verse 13 again. What does that verse mean to you? I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me. I have a calmness of spirit. There may be troubles. And you know, you'll all, as you go through life, you'll face troubles. I know you're young now, but you may already have already suffered some sadness in your life. Maybe you've lost a loved one. Or maybe there are different trials that you face. But throughout life, you'll find there'll be various things that'll test your spirit, that'll test your faith. But if you turn to the Lord and recognize He is the one who has said, you know, you'll never be tempted above that which He's able to help you. He is able to come to your side. And that's why Paul could say, I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. Because I believe in the Christ. That influences others. You see somebody who goes through a real serious trial of their life, and you see them with a calmness of spirit, a deep kind of faith, and people say, boy, I wish I had that. What is it that enables you to be that way? What is it that keeps you calm? And maybe, you know, you've just lost a loved one, and yet
you sorrow, are not as others who have no hope. I tell you, through my life, I've preached a lot of different funerals. The kind of funerals where the person has really not been a godly person and everybody there knows it. The kind of weeping and wailing. It's just really, it's soul stirring. And then there's the person who has been a faithful Christian. And, you know, just many more people come to that kind of funeral because he's got so many friends. And there's sorrow, but it's not the kind of weeping and wailing that is just beyond comforting. What's the difference? There's a calmness of spirit that can say, I know, I have hope for this individual. And so there's the calmness of spirit. No matter what happens in life, if we truly have faith in the Lord, does that have an influence on others? I tell you, there are people who come to those kind of funerals and look around and they are amazed. They wonder, how can you go through such a time? Maybe this person has had cancer and had a horrible leading up to death, but finally dies, and the people who are around them say, boy, you know, this individual faced death with a sense of serenity and calmness. And those loved ones around them, yes, they're grieving, but it's altogether different from the one who has no hope. I say to you, when you have that kind of a spirit that says, I trust in the Lord, your influence on others would be very significant. Yes, again, thank you.
Interesting example, Paul, in the midst of a storm, they're going to have a shipwreck. And they're ready to, they've given up life. And there he is.
In Acts chapter 27.
Yeah. In verse 34, he says, therefore I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, for not a hair from the head of any of you shall perish. And having said this, he took bread, gave thanks to God in the presence of all. And he broke it and began to eat. And all of them were encouraged. And they themselves also took food.
Yes. Can you imagine here, you know, the shipwreck, and yet Paul's calmness of spirit was accompanied all the rest. I said the Christian faces troubles differently from the one who does not have conviction. So your influence by your conviction, by your commitment, by your courage, by your confidence in God, and even your calmness in the midst of trials. And then point number six, by your Christ-like spirit. One of the things that's not in the book of Daniel is murmuring and complaining. Why did God let me be taken a captive over here in Babylon? It's just not there. Why did God allow this kingdom to throw me into the lion's den? It's not there. Sometimes there are people who want to blame God for every trouble in life. But that's not in the book of Daniel. It's not in Paul's writing of the New Testament. And though he goes through a lot of trials, it's just a total difference between the one who really has the Christ-like spirit. Even there may be others who mistreat you. People who don't believe may say things that they shouldn't and do things they shouldn't to you. But sometimes even they are amazed when you respond in a different way. In Ephesians chapter 4, instead of me quoting it to you, let's go look at it. Ephesians 4 and verse 32. Our attitude toward others, even when maybe they mistreat us, should be like what? Someone else have that? Ephesians 4, 32. Be what? Kind. Tenderhearted. Do what?
Forgiving
in what way?
God in Christ also forgive you.
Even as God in Christ also forgiven you. How many of us think we deserve forgiveness? We don't deserve it. It's by the grace of God, forgiveness. But here is, even as God for Christ's sake, King James Version, I believe, renders it, has forgiven you. So ought we to forgive others. That spirit that doesn't always retaliate evil for evil, but rather returns good for evil. What an influence. You never know. That person in the world that really is ungodly in their attitude and nature, maybe a roommate, maybe a classmate, maybe somebody you know that has just begun to say things and do things towards you that really is unrighteous and ungodly. And yet you can have you don't return evil for evil, but you return good for evil. the influence that it has. They are amazed. People are amazed when you can react with kindness and tenderness and even forgiveness. And Jesus on the cross, either Father, forgive them, or they know not what to do. Your influence is great. And then finally, the consistency. It's not just when it's convenient to be a light in the world. It's not just when, you know, everything is going right and I can be salt that influences for good. But there's a sense of consistency. Daniel is a young man. Daniel is an old man. In fact, it's an interesting statement in Daniel chapter 6. When Darius now, we say, here's a man who's maybe in his 80s. And the king has thrown him in to the lion's den, and he's marveling at this. The statement quoted in the scripture is, your God, whom you serve continually. Serve God continually. Daniel did not have anything you cannot have. You can have conviction, commitment, courage, confidence, calmness, and forgiveness. But do you make a similar impression on those around you that you constantly serve the God in whom you believe? Is the life of the Lord seen in you? You know, we're not perfect, but if our attitude is right, then we do make a mistake. Others will know we did not purposefully and willingly do it. So in the conclusion, I want you to think about what will be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. How many are going to be in heaven because of your life? You know, first and foremost, you want to save yourself, but along the way, what would you do with others? Really, you notice that last sentence, you do not have any choice whether you influence another. You only choose whether it's for good or bad. The hypocrite has an influence for bad. The consistent serving of God as an influence for good. I hope you think about it. You consider, am I a light in the world? Do I let my life so shine before men that they may glorify God as a result? Well, I hope these thoughts will be helpful and that you maybe take this outline and read it and maybe go back to the book of Daniel and reread that great story about the servant of God called Daniel. Okay?